Welcome back. I think we're at episode 328. I think we're recording the eve of Christmas Eve. Joe, Merry Christmas. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Tim, and Merry Christmas to you and all the Kellys.
Thank you so much. Well, let's get right into it. There was, before we get into the, I guess, our topical issues, I guess this is topical, strictly speaking, but we're going to talk about some of the anti-white Christmas and some of these movies that are coming out, are expected to come out. There was a ruling that came out. It's important, but it turns out it's simply not important in the final analysis because it's not enforceable. The Colorado State Court removed Donald Trump from the 2024 presidential ballot, citing the Article 3 of the 14th Amendment dealing with insurrection. The Supreme Court ruled that Donald J. Trump, the 45th president of the United States, was disqualified from appearing on their state's ballot in the upcoming 2024 election. The ruling states that the former president is not eligible to run for the White House because he is somehow guilty of violating the nation's 14th Amendment ban on insurrection, referring to the Capitol, January 6th protest at the Capitol in 2021. If you recall, that was when the electoral colleges were being received and certified by the Congress, and there was an expected challenge to these things given the multiple irregularities of the 2020 presidential election. Despite media claims, there's much evidence of all types of shenanigans and fraud, mass electoral fraud through paperless ballots and these things in corrupt cities like Milwaukee and Detroit, Atlanta, Philadelphia, notoriously corrupt cities. Obviously, the 2020 elections were worse because of the, I think the 10 times increase. I think it was more than 10 times, maybe it was 20 times. I forget the number. It was many order of magnitude of paper ballots because of the I'm sorry, mail-in ballots, because of the COVID-19 scam. But none of us. There was a protest. Many people felt that Donald Trump was cheated out of his second term, and then there was a raucous protest. We now know that. To the extent that their protest became a riot, became raucous. It appears there were multiple agents from the FBI and federal assets there stirring things up, as we all know that's par for the course. FBI still hasn't admitted how many agents they had there. But nevertheless, this sort of raucous event was sort of, I guess, transmogrified into an insurrection by the media. And that term insurrection and sedition started being used, and apparently the Supreme Court of Colorado in a 4-3 ruling is somehow claiming that Donald Trump, although he has not been tried or charged with insurrection, is guilty of insurrection. Ironically, it violates the due process clause of the very amendment they're citing, and they're saying just because I suppose some talking heads on CNN and MSNBC and some politicians have used the word insurrection that he's indeed guilty of insurrection because of the riots. That, of course, this is notwithstanding the year prior of all the rioting. It went on with BLM with the support of many Democrats, particularly the current vice president of the United States, Kamala Harris. And but nevertheless, it's a ruling. Apparently, it's not going to be enforced because it's anticipated that I think the Trump campaign has already appealed it to the Supreme Court, and people are expecting it will be rejected. And so this is much to do about nothing, really. But it is a dangerous precedent because what they're saying is just because you can accuse someone of something in public, you can exclude them from participating in the electoral process. So again, what say you?
Well, the purpose of it, of the ruling, was just to create the impression for heritage American Europeans that democracy is being taken away. I mean, it obviously, in terms of its legal, kind of logic, it's ridiculous. This was not an insurrection in any kind of sense of the word. And the, taking a presidential candidate off of the ballot is fairly extreme sort of act that you'd need to have, really powerful evidence. And of course, the 14th Amendment is It has to do, it has been historically in terms of things like the Confederate Army and the Weimar. These are the only two things that have ever been associated with, you know, being able to be justified as qualifying as an actual insurrection that would preclude people from being able to be elected. So the ludicrous individuals who are trying to go into the Capitol, you know, to call them an insurrection is, of course, silly. So why would they do it? Well, it's, you know, as I said, it's just because it's just another step of removing the sense of democracy, removing the sense that if you, you know, that the political system is something that we own and that it produces meaningful effects for our lives. You know, here, this is just an example of how tenuous it all is, how fragile, how it can all just go away just with, you know, one judicial decision. And there's the end of the representation of kind of European legacy America, Donald Trump. He just disappears off the ballot. So that's all it is. It's just these things are in an overall sense, overarching, are, you know, meant to make heritage Americans feel impotent and disassociated from the country. And so they just keep coming at us one after another.
Yeah. Why? I mean, following the logic of this ruling, various states could remove Joe Biden from the ballot for his, I think we'll call treasonous actions or inactions regarding the border. You could really get things going here, just the same way that local DAs could start charging, you know, Clintons and Biden with all types of fraud, and much more legitimate than it had with Trump, by the way, because we do have a prima facie evidence for Biden's, you know, being involved in mass influence peddling, bribery scam regarding Ukraine.
Sure, but it's just a very bad precedent and a bad process, because at the end of it, democracy just goes up in smoke.
Well, another thing is, if they can just start changing the definition of words, what's the point of having text and law? Because insurrection means something. If you say that was an insurrection, as well, what, they were protesting the election, they weren't protesting the legitimacy of Congress to ratify the Electoral College. They were trying to put pressure. The protest ostensibly was to either back up, support those in Congress who are supposedly challenging, which is legitimate. You don't have a certification process unless you can anticipate or expect maybe there will be a time when the election is non-certifiable. So why have a certification process? So it isn't just rubber stamp, although that's worked out that way. You only have a certification process because you anticipate there might be a time when there's problems with election, that the election indeed cannot be certified. But nevertheless, if you can just change the meaning of the word, say, oh, it's insurrection, and then say, I'm going to call you insurrectionist, and therefore there's an insurrection clause, therefore you can't run. First of all, the law doesn't apply to the President of the United States. It applies to officers. Second of all, the insurrection clause was specifically tailored towards those who had taken part in the North called the rebellion. And Alexander Stevens, they didn't want Alexander Stevens to serve in Congress or something like that. So it was dealing specifically with the war that had just ended. And so, and not to mention the sort of the constitutional problems regarding the 14th Amendment itself, but that's water under the bridge. The 14th Amendment is very problematic. All those post-Civil War Reconstruction amendments are problematic because those amendments were ratified under conditions that were never contemplated by the Constitution itself. That is, the South was an occupied military zone at the end of the war.
Yeah.
The South had seceded. I
just want to point out that we always have to remember, in my opinion, that the whole 1-6 protest and the resultant accusations of insurrection were a theatrical process. Mm-hmm. In other words, the whole thing was artificial. Trump certainly knew what Pence was going to do. The kind of insinuations that had gone out, you know, about how there could be an overturning by Pence, and that they needed to have, you know, support for him, if you came to watch, I mean, all of the, if you look at QAnon and all the things that were promoting, you know, a whole bunch of white people to go to Washington, D.C., and then, you know, show support for Pence and to try to restore a democratic reality to America. look, that was all theatrical, and Trump played a role in it. I mean, he certainly knew what Pence was going to do. And of course, Pence knew what Pence was going to do. So there was no reason for anyone to ever come to provide support for Pence. I mean, that was this was what they were, you know, being led into just for this theatrical production of the pseudo insurrection, which was then going to be given to the country as an example of how, look, you know, white males are terrorists and can't, you know, white supremacy. The Democratic Party, I mean, Nancy Pelosi was anticipating all this. They'd all gone into a bunker before, you know, the event had occurred. They were all there to create this drama. It was all being videotaped. So it was just a theater of, unfortunately, a theater of the absurd, which ends up with the idea of now they've got this propaganda mean, which is stupid and kind of, I don't know, unbelievable, but nevertheless, there it is. You have to put up with the idea of like 1/6 shows that, you know, there is this white supremacy problem in America. And and removing Trump from the ballot is a really kind of clarifying moment because it shows what the purpose of the theatrical production was. It isn't Trump that's being removed from the ballot. It's the white male. That's who they're really having in mind of removing from the ballot. Trump's just a figurehead.
Yeah, the whole thing of sort of trying to turn into some a white supremacist protest. Even at the January 6th hearings, the chairman was started talking about, you know, he's black and he's a descendant of slavery. Has that anything to do with what they're essentially looking into, which is the January 6th right? Nor did they look into, of course, that was theatrical as well. And that's, most people kind of acknowledge that now, just pure politics. But of course, more than 1,000 people have been put in prison, convicted. Yeah. to support the theatrics. So there's real suffering here, people paying the price. By the way, people paying the price are the hoi polloi, not Donald Trump, and certainly not any politicians. It's the people that thought they had a right to show up at the nation's capital and protest. And they find out, well, they don't have that right. Yeah. It's not, right's not acknowledged by the powers that be. Of course, following on that, there's a in the Arlington National Cemetery, the U.S. Defense Department has decided to remove a reconciliation monument. Of course, this dates back to, again, the Civil War, at least the Reconstruction period of the Civil War. It was a monument constructed by sculptor Moses Ezekiel, who is Jewish, so maybe removing the monument is anti-Semitic. I'm not hearing the ADL talk about that. But, of course, they're removing the reconciliation monument. So what does the Biden administration have against reconciliation? Well, this is further disenfranchising the heritage America, white America, if you will, from the history of the nation's culture. And the people doing this are either they're radicals or ignoramuses. They don't care. They have no understanding of the nation's history. These monuments themselves are sort of propaganda, so it is what it is. But it's, you know, they're removing these wonderful pieces of art, removing the statue. It's aesthetically, it's bad just because it harkens back to another time and there's images. And another thing is people just simply don't understand is this solipsism of this thing. They actually think that the Civil War was all about slavery. And it simply isn't the case. This historically is not factual. It wasn't all about slavery. But it's been turned into being all about slavery because if you make it all about slavery, then you can make the white man the bad guy. But the problem is the arguments they're making against the former Confederacy can be used against the entire Union, and pretty soon there'll be statues being taken on George Washington, Thomas Jefferson. I mean, Thomas Jefferson's Monticello has already turned into an anti-white tour, a guilt trip, one big anti-white guilt trip paid for by, you know, David Rubenstein of the Carlyle Group. That's his flamp that is going to do that. Mount Vernon is on the chopping block. It's all part of, again, of eroding the country. At the same time they're doing this, they're engaging in this iconoclasm. You're getting these rulings out of Colorado, and you get the collapse of the border, the flooding of the country of illegals and non-Americans to transform the country demographically, racially. So it's all part of the same game.
Yeah, I mean, it's all supersession. Mm-hmm. They are the European American in the crosshairs, and I would say that a better description of what they're really claiming about the Civil War is not so much that it was about slavery, is that it was about racism. This was the basis of the Civil War, and it's the basis for basically all history
Oh, and by the
that.
way, those engaging in that conflict didn't even know what racism was, because the word didn't exist
Course not. And the whole thing is ludicrous, but this is it's about racism. And the removal of the monuments is to punish the people who put up the monuments and the people who find pleasure or some sort of meaning looking at events in their past. They're racist too, and so they're being replaced. This is supersession. This is supersession. This is what you're seeing. This is a psychological supersession, but then of course it becomes a real one, as they bring in hordes of people of color, to use an expression, from the South, to jam the ballot box and to make any sort of heritage American European, his even in fact his ballot is being diluted, not just by the artificial kind of ballot stuffing that goes on in the corrupt cities, but really it's being diluted because all of these people coming across the border are going to be given ballots eventually, and they'll all vote only one way, so this is what you're looking at is supersession. The what the white people were being accused of, in like 1-6 or the Civil War, all these perspectives of history that are being given to us, it's actually happening to us. This isn't a theory here. I mean, this is actually going on in our country, and they're going to make it into this giant clump of people, different perspectives, poorly educated, all needing government assistance. And just imagine how easy it will be to control. I mean, they'll just be a clump of a herd of animals would be a good description. And so the power of the people inside of the United States will be, taken away, and what will be left will just be the Judeo-Masonic oligarchs with their political system and their various means of control over it, and that'll be America.
Speaking of people of color, Democratic Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, she's a Chinese American, threw a holiday party, not a Christmas party, holiday party, for electeds of colors. I think this became a scandal, not because she held the gatherings, because apparently an assistant or someone in her office, yeah, her assistant who is black, Denise Dos Santos, accidentally sent invitations to the entire city council, some of whom are still white, ethnic whites. And the mayor said sending the email to white city council was an honest mistake, and she apologized for sending the email. But she did not apologize for holding the gathering, but she did. It was an electeds of color gathering. Again.
Well, I mean, what do you expect? World Economic Forum, George Soros funded. I mean, Wu is just a, an automaton of kind of the Open Society Foundation. How any kind of person of European background could vote for someone like this is beyond me. I mean, she is just her actions are the act, and she doesn't realize it. I mean, she's a puppet, but her actions are simply that of a racist in opposition to what she believes is, evil white suppression culture, and therefore that is the target. The Christmas party was just a reflection of her view of the world, right? That this is that obviously that's how she sees it. So this is basically a race war that she's engaged in, and the people in Boston, I think, I'm not sure what the demographics are, but I'm sure there's still a large fraction of them who are like white people, to use an expression. So why in the hell would any of them vote for? Why wouldn't they organize politically around opposition to what is obviously an attack against them? I mean, Wu's Christmas party should just be, a clarification of what their circumstances are.
But nevertheless, it's become sort of normalized, I guess. And it's funny that her being a Chinese American, Asian, that she gets on sort of this, she tries to play the I guess the part, tries to herself identify as a BIPOC, you know, a person of color and a grieved person, as she is something. Of course, at one point or another, her family came to the United States. Then she here she comes to the United States, evidently does well, then trashes it. You know, this is something that is very rude, to say the least. But this is just something that she's received the progressive education, all the propaganda, and this is just normal for her. And of course, to her to yell at white people for being racist, or to hector white people for being racist, is ironic, because my experience is, I mean, it's white people are much less racist or racially conscious than Chinese, even Chinese Americans. That's my own personal experience. Some of the most harsh, I guess, examples
Yeah, well,
come
Tim,
from the tongues of Chinese people regarding people of color. Let's just say that.
ask the Tibetans how the Chinese get along with people
Yeah.
of color, you know. I mean,
But if you're, again, if you're yellow, you're slightly brown, or if you're, shall we say, you know, swarthy, you just don't feel that guilt. That's this is racism is something is a crime that is only applied to ethnically white people, European people. And of course, we can get into why that's the case, and who has the power to project that, to promote that those attitudes, to put them in the media and academia, normalize them, institutionalize it, you know, in terms of like civil rights laws, at least how the laws are enforced. You know, so it's something to think about.
well, just remember, I mean, people should never forget that there is a history and context, you know, to Wu and to the, you know, the current position on white people. It's critical theory. It is, you know, a manifestation of cultural Marxism. It has a history, it has individuals, it has philosophy. You can read The Authoritarian Personality and chapter 23 and see it all visible. There it is. And so that's really what Wu is representing. She probably doesn't know this, but it's just this is critical theory where every little thing that a European does and European culture promotes has to be destroyed. Everything. Just a, it's a wasteland of destruction as far as they're concerned, because the Judeo-Masonic individuals who developed critical theory were in opposition to European culture. They wanted to destroy it. They wanted to conquer it. And so what you're really seeing is a long-standing race war with lots of different aspects to it. But critical theory was one of them, and it is now controlling our culture, and it's designed to destroy us. That's our world.
Yeah, here she is having a holiday party, which, of course, Holy Day, that's what it comes from. I guess if they use the term holiday party, they don't have to invoke Christmas, which might offend them. But here she is engaging in a Western tradition where she hates everything Western, European. Now, Christianity itself largely became a European phenomenon for many reasons. One of the things, because the Roman Empire was converted to Christianity in the early 4th century. And you're after in the wake of Roman Empire's disintegration and the rise of Christianity and the conversion of most Romans to the faith, Europe became the faith, and the faith became Europe until the Reformation. And to this day, we still have the vestiges of that culture. This is the Occident.
Sorry.
This is why they hate things Occidental, European, white, if you will. You know what? Even the you know. White is a vestige of that. Boston is a vestige of that. You know, it was, you know, she's the mayor of Boston. You know, talk about Northeastern. Heritage America, and of course, then Boston in the 19th century became largely Catholic because of the Irish that migrated to the city, emigrated to into the United States, and then lived in Boston. But there she is, just you know, pretty much just trashing it all, and just with a sense of. A sense of entitlement, which is something that is something to almost to admire, at least to be on awe of just the attitude. And, but then it's being trashed because she herself is just a sort of a you know, she's a tool of it all. She's been indoctrinated. She's no hypocrisy or irony in having
Yeah,
this.
that's really a good point, is that you know, Wu conducts her political activities in a kind of bubble where there's no tough questions. No one ever accuses her of racism. No one ever accuses her of being a puppet of cultural Marxism. No one ever shows where her money comes from, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't, because that would be racism to attack her in that way. And this is really the most serious problem we face, is that European Americans don't have any political representation that's honest. It's not honest, doesn't actually have the ability to speak about, you know, like, well, we're being attacked, actually. Mm-hmm. And to show who's doing it and how they're doing it and why they're doing it and how Wu is a puppet, right? You can't do that. And you can see this is how the propaganda is so critical. Because European Americans are off balance enough, we're self-correcting enough, we're just been moved sufficiently into the kind of we don't want to be called anti-Semitic or a Holocaust denier or racist, you know, or white supremacist or any of the buzzwords. So we are afraid. We are nervous. We don't have the clarity of mind that you need to speak honestly and openly to someone like Wu, who really needs a good tongue lashing, mm-hmm. right? I mean, she needs a good tongue lashing, because she is basically, she's a liar. You know, her position is not just incoherent. She, you know, and I don't think she is a liar in the sense that she knows consciously she's lying, but her position is just, it's made up of a pack of lies.
Why did she go back to China and run for mayor? Oh, they won't let her.
Well, right. Yeah. Why doesn't she go to Tibet?
Yeah.
And run on grounds of, well, we've got to get rid of racism. Let's see how long that lasts. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's just a ludicrous position, which doesn't have any connection into real history. It's just a lump of propaganda and a pack of lies that's been inserted into her head. She doesn't have the brain power or kind of intellectual skills to work through it. And there's no reason for her to, because she is so funded, financed, and coddled by being part of the, you know, new age political movement, right? This is how she got elected. This is what, you know, pays her way in life. So she's just a paid agent, an insurrectionist, if you were, against mm-hmm. Heritage America. And it's just a lump of sophistry. None of the ideas that she presents as, you know, the historical wrongs that she's correcting, or these things can't stand even 30 seconds of scrutiny, right? They're just ludicrous. And then as far as the political, kind of expertise and future looking that she's presenting, I mean, the city is collapsing. Look, yes. Look at every single Soros-funded mayor DA. Look at these zones. Look at them, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
You can't even maintain civilization inside of these places. If you have any money, you get out. If you're part of the fentanyl brigade, you move in.
Yeah, it might be. She's insufferable. She's also incompetent, which makes it worse.
Yeah, yeah, there it is.
You know, it's kind of like, you know, if they were actually running the city, well, you could probably put up some of their grandstanding and their posturing. But it's like, you know, the power grid's failing. Garbage pickup isn't taking place. Crime's exploding. You know, 10 year city.
What was a great city is just collapsing into the dustbin, into a cesspool. And she has the gall to sit there and to criticize the historical political process, right, that produced something that was actually great, fun to live in, and she chose to move there, and now she's sitting there and wiping it out, and at the same time she's criticizing the people who made it great. So, you know, it's a ridiculous situation where they have been able to get us intimidated enough to the point where we can't speak honestly about what's happening, about the reality that we're experiencing.
The as far as like alien or foreigners coming to the country and immediately trying to change it and subvert it. Let's talk about Christmas, the Jewish subversion of Christmas. First thing was, this was a sort of imposition of Hanukkah on Christmas. This took place. Hanukkah really, it's been referred to as sort of the Jewish Kwanzaa. It's not really a big Jewish holiday. It doesn't date back to the Old Testament. It actually dates back to the 19th century, by two rabbis in Cincinnati that promoted it to, well, one thing. I mean, I guess I can understand this, to reinforce or defend Jewish identity in a sea of Christians. Now, of course, the United States itself, although technically not a Christian nation, culturally definitely overwhelmingly Christian, and so in the 19th century, you had a lot of Jews come to the United States. Particularly in the late 19th century, and those who had the wherewithal, the power, immediately trying to undermine Christianity because they felt insecure, the fact that they were surrounded by Christians. Of course, they emigrated to a Christian country. Nevertheless, they felt the right to subvert it and change it. And these two rabbis, I think it was a Rabbi Isaac M. Wise of the Plum Street Temple, and Rabbi Max Lilienthal of the Mound Street Temple, introduced Hanukkah festivals to their congregations to promote Jewish identity. And so this wasn't really a big thing until the I think late 20th century, when you started having menorahs pop up everywhere. Then you have sort of this Jewish back litigation, particularly by the ACLU and the American Jewish Committee, to de-Christianize or to pull religion out of the public square under the pretext of the First Amendment Non-Establishment Clause. It was a perversion of that, of course, but this was used to challenge the presence of creches even menorahs at public squares, courthouses, and these are a general expression of the I guess the values of the dominant community, which are Christian. It wasn't sectarian, it was just a Christian. It was generally Christian, which then doesn't violate the First Amendment, nor it doesn't represent an establishment of a state church, is what the First Amendment was designed for. Nevertheless, litigation and modern authority, if you will, of judicial interpretation, has extended that to mean separation of church and state, a phrase which does not appear in the Constitution anywhere. It was a letter written by Thomas Jefferson. It was a sentiment expressed by Thomas Jefferson, something he wanted, but there's no standing in constitutional law. Nevertheless, it has been incorporated into constitutional law to extra to pull religion, and particularly Christianity, out from the public square and its influence and culture and its political influence. At the same time, of course, in the ensuing void that's created by this, you have increasing Jewish influence. And now you have menorahs popping up anywhere. There was an odd decision in the 1980s that found that although the presence of a Krish or a nativity scene at a courthouse was a violation of the First Amendment, the presence of a menorah was not.
Right.
Ironically, it was a court case that was, I think, ACLU. I think this was a setup because the ACLU opposed both. But I think they got the results they wanted. Was that now you have, again, more Jewish supersession, where the menorah is now figured, prominent menorahs are put up, and that these are put outside usually to satisfy the
Yeah.
court's decision.
You
But
know,
the Christian influence is one thing, and by equating it, you belittle the Christian influence because, again, the Hanukkah, the menorah is not a big Jewish holiday. It's an exaggeration, but it's to crowd out Christmas. It's a Jewish attempt, more Jewish culture regression, to crowd out Christmas, push in the menorah, and have the effect. So.
well, it's racism. People kind of forget the history of Hanukkah.
No, it's not bringing Hanukkah is not bringing people together, is
Right. I mean,
it?
well, what it is, it's to create and promote the separate Jewish identity, which can be, racism. That's how you can kind of one of the expressions of it. But Hanukkah, starts out with, the Maccabean rebellion. What the Maccabees were revolting against was the fact that the Jews of Judea, Palestine, were integrating. This was the big problem. The Seleucids were promoting Greek culture. It was a lot of fun. It had, all of these elements, and it was absorbing the Jews of the region. And the fundamental Jews, the racist Deuteronomy reading, clump. They said, no, this isn't going to work. And so then that's what the Maccabean Rebellion was to do, was to get rid of the integration and the Greek culture that was onsetting. And so they revolted, and that's what Hanukkah celebrates, is this bizarre miracle of like a candle staying lit or something, So it's a pretty weak miracle, actually, if you look at it. But what's interesting is that this was also then the same thing that happened with Reform Judaism. Reform Judaism was actually kind of the same process that was going on during the Seleucid period, where the Jews were starting to integrate. And they produced all of these, I've talked about them many times, you know, Abraham Geiger and a whole bunch of guys that were really kind of running Judaism. They were the premier intellectuals of this era. And they were saying things like, you know, the Jewish prophets are really for all mankind. This really, our religion, and should not be Zionism. They were absolutely opposed. They could see that Zionism was the exact opposite direction of where they wanted to take the religion. Mm-hmm. They wanted to integrate into European culture fully. And so this was what the current stream of Zionism was most opposed to at the very beginning and had to destroy. They had to get rid of all these individuals. And this then was the second kind of Seleucid, problem. And it led to the current situation, like which going on today in Gaza, where you can see where the fundamental, which is to say racist Jews, have control of the religion and of the political process and are now, you know, wiping out people in order to create their ethnically pure region. And at the same time, their minions, their puppets like Wu, are accusing Europeans of doing what they are in fact doing, you mm-hmm. see. And so you have this irony that is deep and casts a shadow over our entire world, where the only individuals that are really behaving in the way that Wu would criticize as this evil concept are the Jews, who are the ones who are funding her, basically, through Soros and et al. And all that group. So it's a strange world, isn't it? You know.
Yeah, the again, it's anti-Semitism. Indeed, it's genocide to oppose genocide.
That's the, and you'll get the genocide if you do, you know.
Yeah. You sort of, again, they're sort of nudging aside of Christmas. Of course, there, Steven Spielberg, I think, came out with a movie a couple of years ago. I think it was sort of a personal biography about his upcoming, how he got in the film and all that. And the movie's about his Jewish family being surrounded by a bunch of Christians and them being feeling left out. Well, if that's the case, leave. I mean, their reaction is to try to undermine everyone's faith in Christianity. You're the interloper. You're the one that came in. You're the one that emigrated.
Irving Berlin. Yes. You know, writer, author of White Christmas and that song that kind of replaced Easter. I forget the name of it, but.
Yeah, all those Christmas songs, right?
Right, all those Christmas songs, which have no idea about, or which have no promotion of kind of historical European Christian culture, but are, you know, trying to take it into a secular.
Yeah, the songs used to be Joy to the World, Silent Night, Little Town of Bethlehem, all these.
Yeah, that stuff, you know, European culture, Christian culture, but that was replaced with Irving Berlin. Now Berlin, that's not his real name. It's not Irving. It's Israel. That's his real name, mm-hmm. Israel Berlin. And which I don't think even Berlin is his real name. But anyway, his first name was actually Israel. And it's interesting because just like Norman Lear, like last, you know, we talked about how Lear would listen to, a Christian, evangelist talking and wanting to oppose that, wanting to create social media, you know, that would be in opposition to any kind of sort of Christian position, right? That was what was stimulating things like All in the Family. Looking to his history, you can see what, you know, what is animating him. Berlin claimed that he was, his family was a victim of the, the pogroms, mm-hmm. and that his most vivid memory in his childhood was, like Cossacks burning his home. Mm-hmm. So this is the perspective, right, that then he brings to the United States. And, so this background should be understood by people who listen to his music, that it isn't, you know, it's not intended to be harmless or, you know, to promote family get-togethers. It's supersession. He's obviously looking at his background and how he's expressing himself. You know, what he's doing is trying to create an alternative culture and get rid of the existing culture. And of course, Berlin was a huge Freemason, high-level Freemason, right? So oddly enough, here we have the Judeo-Masonic Union once again. And lo and behold, the individual who promotes this perspective is creating culture which is supersessive, right? It's getting rid of the historical Christian culture. So you can see, again, you can see the context of all this if you look at it historically. You can see what is going on and who is doing it.
Yeah, I think it was Philip Roth, the Jewish writer, who commented on this. He wrote, "If supplanting Jesus Christ with snow can enable my people to cozy up to Christmas, then let it snow, let it snow, let it snow." He turned Christmas into from the celebration of the birth of the Savior to a weather report. And of course, Easter from the celebration of the resurrection of our Savior to a fashion show with Easter parade. So, this is the Jewish, and yet at the same time, you're nudging Christianity out and all its cultural influences in the ensuing void. Society becomes Judaized under the banner of pop culture, and that's and consumerism. It goes to the promotion of toys and these things and buying presents. That as you nudge aside the religious aspect, the consumer aspect comes into play. And that all features into the mass marketing effect of the 20th century, mass production, these things, with whole marketing and the development of department stores and toys for kids. And this speaks to the demographics of the mid 20th century and what they did with Christmas. Of course, the music itself, again, at the same time, if you turn on the radio, you hear one time you hear all these Christmas songs that were religious oriented. Little Town of Bethlehem, Joy to the World, Silent Night, Hark the Herald Angels, these things, Winter Wonderland, it's the most wonderful time of the year, rocking around the Christmas tree, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, which is a very Jewish story, if you really look into it, deconstruct it. This also coincides with the promotion of Hanukkah. And the Jewish supersession that occurred in the mid 20th century, the Jewish ascendancy, both of economic and political power, something that had been even immense even in the early 20th century, almost within a couple of decades, they were able to bring a lot of power to influence to bear to change, pretty much direct the course of the country, particularly its involvement in two world wars in the first part of the 20th century. Most of the Christmas songs people are familiar with were written by Jews. And there's a reason why that, because Jews had a tremendous influence and a dominant influence in the music industry, the entertainment industry. Pop culture is Jewish culture. It's just the way it is, because they dominate the institutions that produce popular culture, music, movies, and television.
I would suggest that Christians stop using the expression Christian music to, describe things like Berlin's ditties. I would say they should call that Festivus or,
yes.
But I'm serious. Have another name for it.
By the way, that was a reference to Seinfeld, of course.
Yeah. So in other words, it doesn't have the propaganda effect of blurring what is actually Christian culture. I mean, there's nothing Christian about Berlin's Festivus songwriting, right? Mm-hmm. And so it should be delineated. It helps people have clarity. There is Christian music, and that can be called this, but this modern stuff should be called, and there should be a different term for it.
I remember as a kid growing up, looking forward. This is a time when, of course, we didn't have streaming or DVD players or whatever, YouTube, we can watch whatever we want. But every year, they would broadcast to Charlie Brown's Christmas, usually on CBS, if I recall. And I think that premiered in 1965. And of course, Charles Schulz was a devout Catholic. And that ending, when Linus tells Charlie Brown what the real meaning of Christmas is, he quotes the gospel. Charles Schulz demanded that be put in. The people in the network did not want that put in.
Of course not.
And he said, I'm not going to be involved in this thing. And that was at a time when, even then, as late as 1965, the Jews that controlled CBS had to genuflect to Christian sensibilities.
Yeah, they wanted Charlie Brown to be another Festivus
Yes.
cartoon, and Schultz said, "Nah, I'm a Christian person, and I want it to reflect my culture."
Yes,
And
and there was one of the greatest moments in broadcast television
he had
history.
enough clout and power to actually pull it off, and
Yes.
this should be an inspiration to subsequent generations of individuals who are in that position. Unfortunately,
Yes.
they've been able to squash Christian culture to the extent that there are very few
And
people
by the
that
way,
have.
look at that date. 1965 is key. Because so
Yeah,
much happened in 1965.
what comes out these days are things like the film "Leave the World Behind," Obama's movie. I think that's the title, isn't it?
Yeah.
What is the title of the darn thing?
Leave the world behind, yes.
Yeah, "Leave the World Behind." Now you suggested that we might chat about this, and so I watched it, or at least skim through it. I was able to fast forward through the nightmare propaganda device, but it is a clear unit of propaganda. That's all it is, and it's so aggressive in its evil propaganda kind of structure that is, I think it's almost diminishing returns. I mean, to me, this is just now it's so clear what they're trying to do with your mind that there might be a reaction against it. The film has the wife is the one who initiates everything. She's really the man of the family. The white male is impotent, doesn't do anything.
Does he
I guess
actually say he's good for nothing in the
yeah,
movie?
or something like that. I mean, I
He says,
but
I'm not good for anything. He actually says that.
she's
Ethan
getting
Hawke character.
everything organized and is animated, and he's just asleep in bed, not doing anything. And above him, interestingly, is a huge crack. They have this big crack in the wall, kind of indicating, his kind of the collapse and the destruction of the history and the culture that this guy is representing. It's just a the again, it's supersession. They rent this house. The world collapses, where they're not really sure what's going on. Two people show up. It's a black man in a tuxedo and his little degenerate sex pot daughter. And they turn out to own the house. So again, you have, who is the wealthy people? And, it's the black guy. He has some technical job, very high. He's like
He's
Morgan.
smarter and more sophisticated,
Oh,
much
he's
more
much,
than.
I mean, the white male is, I mean, he really could be representing like an autistic individual. He has just no mental power whatsoever. It's the black male and the white female who get kind of, they organize. It's designed to the film is designed to frighten people. I always talk about how the intimidation is their, goal in so many areas. This film has no real purpose for existing. It doesn't really have a plot per se. It just has it just scares people. Your technology's being taken away. You don't really know what's going on. There's Arab terrorism, that's there's pamphlets being dropped down. You don't really know what anything means. A huge freighter comes on board, lands on the beach with it's called the White Lion, the lion obviously symbolizing, a particular race. And so the white guy is impotent, stupid, and afraid through the entire film. And at one point, the black guy, the smart black guy, is talking to his degenerate sexpot daughter, and he says, "Don't, if things go south here with everything falling apart, you can't trust white people. White people just can't be trusted." And then they have a little kind of Freemasonic, symbolism, like the house that the guy goes to visit, trying to find help. The name of the family is the Huxleys. Okay, great. Brave New World. At the end, there's atomic bombs going off, and the Julia Roberts character is holding hands with the black lady, and the white female young girl. This is what the point of the title then is now explained. At the end, she goes into a bunker and turns on Friends, you know, the TV sitcom. She'd been wanting to see the conclusion, but the technology failed. She couldn't see it. And so now she literally leaves the world behind. And what does she do? She plugs in Jewish Hollywood's propaganda, anti-family, ludicrous sitcom, some Friends. And that's how the film ends. The world has been left behind. This is as it's presented, it is a positive thing. Simply go in your bunker and watch TV and let everything, cease to exist. That's really that is the moral, kind of message of the film. It's just leave the world behind, which is to say, give up any idea about political or financial power. You don't have any of that. Leave it behind. Get into a bunker, hide, right? They have a character who's like Kevin Bacon plays, who's like hoards water and food. He's just prepping, but not to do anything politically, but just to like survive for a few months or whatever. And then the conclusion where the white daughter, goes into a bunker and just leaves the world behind and watches Friends. So there it is. It's just very aggressive, destructive propaganda. You don't want young people, young European people, anyone to see this thing, who isn't, kind of understanding it as propaganda. So, for God's sakes, don't let any of your family members watch this thing without some kind of analysis of it, so they know what's going on. And the fact that Obama was a consultant on it, I mean, my God, it's just, as I said, it's aggressive propaganda and, just stupid in the extreme.
Well, yeah, just the whatever, you don't trust white people. There's at least three, what does that mean? I mean, white people? I mean, it's like, it's not something I gather when I watch the news and see things like there's a power affair, the blackout somewhere, and people are looting. I don't see white people looting.
It's hilarious. It's just
No.
hilarious. What a good
I mean,
point. I mean, don't trust white people. That's what the black guy, the smart black guy, says to his degenerate sex bot daughter, who is, accusing the white males of wanting to have sex with her, and asking really risque and provocative questions to the white male,
yeah,
you
it's
know.
almost like she's such a dislikable character. It
Oh,
almost
she's
has
just miserable.
the opposite. I think it has even the father character kind
It's
of ignores her.
diminishing returns. I mean, they
Yeah.
can't construct these propaganda things in a way where these characters are actually likable, because they just can't be. It's impossible. They're distorting reality to too great a degree in order to get the propaganda
Well,
aspect.
so isn't he like a supporter of the Philharmonic or something, classical music? Okay, well, yeah.
But I
Disparage
was just gonna.
white people, but classical music is a creation of European culture.
Well, sure. I just wanted to get back to your point, is
I mean,
that
and the
here.
technology that they're all availing themselves of. I mean, it's what's collapsing around them at the time. I mean, it's like,
Yeah, I mean, but that one phrase, which is "don't trust white people." I mean, just think about that. What he's talking about is a condition where there'd be rioting. You
yes.
see, now we have seen this. We know there is actual historical documentation on who does what during the riot, during these blackout periods, during times
Yes.
when the technology fails. It's not the white people. White people, you don't have to worry about the white people in general. It's other groups that actually do the looting, are prone to
Well,
violence
thing is,
during.
they're not even looting out of death. They're looting out of a sense that there's no one there to enforce the law anymore, and it's an opportunity. Yeah. Whereas, white people will generally know to bide their time and know if they just, keep their cool, things will get back in line once again. But you know, saying they don't even. To them, a power outage is just an opportunity to create mayhem. They don't even need that anymore. If you look at what's going on in Chicago, San Francisco, Philadelphia, anyone, it's like, please. There's another movie. Apparently, did you see that one? It's due out in March, I think. It's called The American Society of Magical Negroes.
Oh,
It's
right. I've heard about this.
a now it is a satire. And I don't know what they're trying to make fun of here, because the notion, you watch this stuff and you think, are they making fun of how black people look at things? Are they making fun, or are they trying to insult white people? Because I'm reminded of a there was a skit on Saturday Night Live made in the 80s with Eddie Murphy, and he was an undercover reporter going as an undercover white person to find out what happened how white people will behave when all the black people leave. And it was, he gets on a bus, and the last black person gets off the bus, and all of a sudden there's a cocktail party. He goes into a bank as a white person, and there's a the person
Except
that's
all
sitting
the money you
desk
want,
is a black person, and he wants to look at his credit and go through the due diligence that you would expect from a loan. And the white bank president says, Leroy, go take your break. And here's money. You're white. Have all the money you want. And of course, the whole point of that skit was to make fun of black paranoia, black solipsism in a way. It was so outrageous. It wasn't like no one really took it at that time. It was making fun of how black people view things. I'm watching this movie, and it is a comedy. But there is a line in there that where the protagonist, I think he's recruited into the secret society of African Americans, black people, if you will, whose job is to make life easier for whites because you don't want white people angry, which is interesting. Interesting that that would be the attitude. Keep make them happy because if they're alerted or aroused, they're very dangerous. I would say, in a sense, that word dangerous is very funny because what do you mean by dangerous? Because there's no group of people, Europeans that are more capable than any other, as far as technology, philosophy, cultural achievement, and these things. So, in a sense, they can be dangerous, and they've proven themselves dangerous because they conquered the freaking planet at one time with their
Well, he means
technology.
dangerous. They can be dangerous in the sense they can organize politically and get
Exactly, they can organize politically.
rid of
So that's
all
a
of
funny
the
thing.
cultural
So
Marxists, you know.
there's a question in there where it says, "What's the most dangerous animal on the planet?" One character asks. White people, when they're feeling uncomfortable, he later adds, "The happier they are, the safer we are," which is funny, or the more dumbed down and less aroused they are. So I don't know. Obviously, the movie comes out in March. I haven't seen the movie, but it could be on the line of that Eddie Murphy skit where it's extreme. I mean, it gets to the point where, but then again, day to day, who's the more dangerous? If I'm looking at the crime stats, even more dangerous to black people, black on white crime, dwarfs white on black crime by
So
a
like a
factor of
100 to
11
1
to
or something.
1. Black on Hispanic crime is double that of white on black crime. White on Hispanic crime is one half of Hispanic on white crime. It also depends on who's Hispanic, who's white. They have skewed the numbers. Bottom line, look at the crime stats. Black on black crime is much more common than white on black crime, and black and white crime is much more common than white on black crime. So who's more dangerous, right? I mean,
Of course, it's like it's a theatrical the presentation of whites as supremacists and dangerous and terror. This is all theatrical. And it's in direct contradiction to the reality that everyone can just stare at, right? I mean, you can just look into every single city and you can see these are obvious facts. It's just being done to like mess with the minds of white people to keep us in that intimidated state where we can't express ourselves honestly. I mean, 3 out of 5, isn't it, illegal households are supported by taxpayer-funded welfare, and the violence that comes out of them is far higher, But if you point this out, well, this is racism, right? So it's, we are just in a world where we have to learn to be honest and to make any kind of political progress in defense of ourselves and representation of ourselves, we have to learn to go through that. We have to transition out of the point of being intimidated. We can't let these buzz expressions, anti-Semitic, white supremacist, all these things that they do to get us to self-correct. We have to get to the point where we just automatically self-correct in the other direction. And we just go, this is sophistry, this is ad hominem, and just move back to the facts and keep trying to keep reality being pushed as something that's important, as opposed to the fantasy, as opposed to, the TV sitcoms like Friends. I mean, this is not a real, world. This is propaganda. This is, we just and but we need to be able to have the guts to call it that. We can't say, hey, it's just and then to let your children be exposed to this culture, right? I mean, come on, what do you expect? You're going to lose that. You're going to leave the world behind if you if you let that process go on very long.
But there's this dominant or prevalent view, of course, it's promoted by the media, entertainment, you know, Hollywood. Of course, it's because those who control Hollywood have an agenda, an anti-white, anti-European, anti-Occidental, anti-Christian agenda. This is why it's so dominant and it's become almost normalized to people like Norman Lear, of course, who we talked about. Right now, there's a Rob Reiner is working on a documentary, I think it's due to come out, about Christian nationalism. And he's trying to, his view is if Christians exert an influence or dominant influence, something that they already did in the United States, as society's going to be taken over a bunch of, you know, redneck hillbillies who are going to lynch everybody and kill all the homosexuals and these things and throw them off buildings and make women either have babies and throw women who are seeking abortions into jail and these things. Ironically, through their lack of discretion and their chutzpahs, they may produce the very thing that they fear, meaning a harsh reaction to these things. But this one thing is we get a sense that whether it's Michelle Wu or Rob Reiner or, you know, various, you know, these black DAs or like the mayor of Chicago, that their anti-white racism or their is born of a sense of grievance and righteousness. And I would say, particularly in terms when it comes to people of color, electeds of color, these people, the whole anti-white idea is born of envy, and we don't hear much talk of envy anymore. And envy is a hatred of the better or the superior. It's sort of dropped out of our moral vocabulary. Liberalism has produced sort of these fuzzy ideas of historical guilt, but we don't no longer talk of original sin or pride or envy. Of course, you know, pride, envy. These are some seven deadly sins, going back to Christianity, of course. We don't talk about those things anymore. And so we have to get the idea that the sort of this hatred of white Christian civilization is born out of envy. And it's a rejection of its virtues more than its failings. So it's not because of the sins of various Christians or white men in the past. It's the success and virtues of white men that they hate. The dominance that Europe wants, and to this day, kind of still kind of a project across the globe, it's born of envy. There was a something that Joe Serban wrote long ago about this, and he wrote, "Western man towers over the rest of the world in ways so large as to be almost inexpressible. It's Western exploration, science, conquest that have revealed the world to itself. Other races feel like subjects to Western power long after colonialism, imperialism, and slavery have disappeared. The charge of racism puzzles whites who feel not hostility, but only baffled goodwill because they don't grasp what it really means. Humiliation. The white man presents an image of superiority even when he isn't conscious of it, isn't even conscious of it. And superiority excites envy. Destroying white civilization is the inmost desire of the League of the designated victims we call minorities." So what they're engaged in, and that's what we see this in iconoclasm, the tearing down of the statues, you see all this art being destroyed, nothing is going in its place. This is an orgy of destruction born of envy.
Yeah, I would even go further and say, if they would just look clearly at the parts of Western civilization that have been demonstrably evil, they would see that really what's in back of that is Freemasonry, which is not, in fact, a reflecting of true European culture. I mean, look at like the lodge system in India, mm-hmm. right? During the Raj era. Look at the Opium Wars, right? The points where European civilization was enslaving, and really, you know, can be honestly criticized in, as, you know, counter humanity.
Judeo-Masonic.
So, yeah, exactly. This is the point. I mean,
but that's the same people that are promoting the destruction of Europeans.
Exactly. You see, so that's why, you know, it's like the people like Wu, the, you know, need to actually look at history more honestly, more accurately. And then they would see that, wait a second, it's not white people that are doing this. Look at the slave trade. I was reading, you know, like, you know, of course, there were actual Europeans involved in the slave trade, but it wasn't the major focus of Europeans. It was a Judeo-Masonic. If you take Judeo-Masonic out of the slave trade, it would be like 1/10 of what it was. It wouldn't even be a cultural element at this point. I mean, there are more Europeans victimized as by being slaves, like the Irish indentured servants were, than there were Europeans and, you know, benefiting like financially from the slave trade. So the whole thing, the whole history that we've been given needs to be reworked to be more honest, more realistic. And, you know, like you stated, if that was done, what you'd see is all of the aspects which are used to promote, you know, kind of a general beneficial human vision, you know, a world of peace, they come from European tradition, as does the science to bring about that effect. Where that culture went wrong, just look and you'll see the Judeo-Masonic influence is there almost every single time.
Yeah. So, well, name one sin that Europeans are guilty of committing collectively that other cultures haven't committed, you know, on an order of magnitude much greater.
Sins like the creation of democracy. Things like that. Yeah, of course.
Well, so polyphonic music, architecture, exactly, philosophy, yeah. So, you know.
If you parse away Judeo-Masonicism from European culture, what you have is the workers' paradise that we really should as a species be trying to head toward. And instead of trying to hate on these individuals and accuse them of, you know, like supremacy and terrorism, they should be looked to for leadership, you know, and trying to move us to a more peaceful world. So this is how upside down things are, is, you know, the people who are good and have the capacity to create, you know, a real world of peace and prosperity, they're being attacked, you know, by the ones that are trying to dominate, destroy, genocide, and have a world under themselves.
Yeah, are descendants of the king of Dahomey ever asked to apologize for their role in slavery?
Right.
Descendants of Genghis Khan, are they apologize for the crimes of their great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-
constructed psychological meme to camouflage their genocide and imperialism, and to make the European culture impotent, so we can't fight back.
Indian hundreds of Indian tribes that made war on each other centuries before the arrival of the evil white men. Do they ever apologize to each other?
No.
It's like, have the Aztecs ever? Oh, they don't exist anymore. But the descendants of the Aztecs, they ever apologize?
Yeah, historical guilt as a concept is very recent. I mean,
it's only applied to,
and it's only applied Europeans. To Europeans, right? Exactly. Yeah.
You know, as if, you know, no. I mean, it's like, do Arabs ever apologize for the Arab slave trade? They wouldn't even think of doing it.
No. Yeah. So. You know, so anyway, this is our world. And, you know, inch by inch, we have to reclaim reality, you know, starts with exposing films like Obama's nightmare propaganda.
Well, it's cheap. It's also cheap grace, because I was talking to someone who was going to the university. The university, some of the orientation of the students, they have a videotape they have to watch in an auditorium about reminding the students that the university is built on stolen land from Indians and from land that was once, tended to by slaves. And it's just a statement that's made. And I was like, well, sorry, are you proposing that the university give the land back to the Indians and also to reimburse the slaves? No. But then it's cheap grace. That's meaning you're just there to make the people who aren't responsible for that, whatever really occurred. And so why even say it? It's again.
I would be 100% in favor of Harvard, Yale,
yes.
Brown, and UC system giving the land back,
making a reservation,
and letting the Indians put casinos on.
Exactly.
The clock.
Yeah, yeah. Let the Indians build Jewish owned casinos.
Right. I mean that would be such an upgrade culturally. It would just be like night and day. So sure, let's go ahead and continue this to its logical conclusion. Get rid of these absurd racism awareness centers run by Judeo-Masonic Soros-funded, billionaires, and give us some good old fashioned
Well, one thing
American
we're learning with this whole
casino.
with the whole Gaza thing, and then the reaction, the hysterical reaction by the Jews, not just Israelis, Jews. I'm talking American Jews. All the billionaires that have given hundreds of millions of dollars to
Yeah.
universities, they expect universities to do what they say. It's like it's exposing these universities as being controlled by Jews
Yeah, it has. And you know,
and the Congress, for that matter.
but also I'm really kind of surprised at how alert the middle class has been concerning the Gaza situation. At least my little small sample size world. I mean, I'm not someone who, takes the pulse in terms of my social activity. I don't really, but from what I can gather, it's really been kind of a sea change.
Yeah,
People are
this is the spike in anti-Semitism. I just did an
Yeah,
interview with E.
what they
Michael
mean
Jones
by that
about it.
is a spike in clarity as
Well, yeah,
to
it's like it's a response to Jewish behavior. It's like, what's
exactly.
causing this spike? Is like, well, I'm troubled by this. It's a response, a reaction to something. It's like I asked E. Michael Jones, what do you think the cause is? He goes, what? Is it the moon? What's causing this spike in anti-Semitic behavior? It could be because they're genociding the Palestinians. It's there for all to see.
Yeah, you know, it'd
Might
be
have
like,
something to do with it. That might have some.
we could ask Irving Berlin, like the pogroms where the Cossacks are burning, like what were the Jews involved in any kind of like financial shenanigans or behavior that was really dangerous and against the interests of the indigenous population? I mean, like, were you guys just really this? Did you just sit there and write Christmas songs all the time? I mean,
And might you
what
be
were you
exact?
actually doing that led to these people feel they needed to actually drive you out? Can we have some discussion of
Yeah,
that,
how about
please?
this? Might you be exaggerating the pogroms a little bit?
Yeah, right,
I
exactly.
mean, the
Yeah.
fact that you call—I'm just saying, because right now we're hearing that if you're if a Jewish student hears a protest on a college campus, it's tantamount to the Holocaust, to another Holocaust.
Well, it is in the same
So
sense because just like
might you be exaggerating?
the Holocaust was as fake as anything, and or certainly has been used in many ways as just propaganda. So the same thing is going on here. It's just a repeat of the same
Well, yeah,
propaganda
the fact that
technique.
you exaggerated the death toll of the World War II by a factor of maybe 10 or 20 to create the Holocaust myth, so you could use that to a guilt trip and beat over the head with people who have the audacity or the temerity to criticize you in the future. You might just be a little skeptical at this point
Yes, exactly.
of your claims of being a victim at this. I'm sorry, it's a little threadbare. It's at this point. So, well, Joe, I think we covered it.
Tim, Merry Christmas to
Merry
you.
Christmas.
And we'll talk as we get towards the new year.
Let it snow. Let it snow.
Let us know. Yeah.
Baby, it's
All
cold
right.
outside.
Yeah. Take care,
Okay,
Tim.
Joe. Take it. Merry Christmas. Bye-bye.
Right.